Good evening. My name is Charles Marsh. I teach in the Department of Religious Studies at the University of Virginia and direct the project on lived theology. And it is my great pleasure to welcome you to this evening's lecture and to introduce you to Professor John DeGruchy, the Robert Selby Taylor Emeritus Professor of Christian Studies at the University of Cape Town, and a friend of mine for some 30 years now. John DeGruchy, as many of you know, is one of the world's most prominent voices in contemporary Christian theology. And tonight we will look closely at his reflections on life and death from his recent book, Led into Mystery, Seeking Answers in Life and Death. During his three-decade tenure of teaching theology and ethics at the University of Cape Town and serving as a minister in the United Congregational Church of South Africa, Professor DeGruchy has become internationally known and admired for his groundbreaking contributions to the study of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, to important international debates in political theology, contextual theology, and theological aesthetics, as well as for his probing analyses on politics, church and state, civic responsibility, and a whole variety of pressing public issues, which he's addressed in conversations, in journals, newspapers, magazines, and articles. And for many years, Professor DeGruchy was at the forefront as a religious leader and theologian in the fight against apartheid in South Africa. With such breadth and range and creativity, it is not surprising that Professor DeGruchy has been a mentor and an inspiration to a generation of theologians and scholars and practitioners seeking to connect academic theology and the practices of justice, peacemaking, and reconciliation. He's the author of many, many books, and I commend them all to you highly. I'll note the ones that I have read and that remain on my desk stand. Professor DeGruchy's Christianity and Democracy, which came out just before the 1996 International Bonhoeffer Congress, which Professor DeGruchy and Archbishop Tutu convened in Cape Town in 1996. Very helpful book called Reconciliation, Restoring Justice. Astonishing book on aesthetics and justice called Christianity, Art, and Transformation, Theological Aesthetics and the Struggle for Justice. A book called Daring Trusting Spirit. It's a biography of Dietrich Bonhoeffer's best friend and biographer, Eberhard Bethge, and a book called Confessions of a Christian Humanist, in which Professor DeGruchy retrieved this nearly forgotten tradition of Christian humanism as a resource for contemporary theology and congregational life. He spoke on this book, in fact, in 2007, when he was the year's distinguished CAPS lecturer in modern Christian thought. And I'd like to note that a number of Professor DeGruchy's lectures from his earlier visits to Charlottesville are on the Project on Lived Theology website, not only the CAPS lectures, but an earlier talk on Holy Beauty, a Reformed Perspective on Aesthetics Within a World of Unjust Ugliness. When I consider Professor DeGruchy's remarkable career, as I was doing again this afternoon with much appreciation, I think of Dietrich Bonhoeffer's words in a fascinating letter called After 10 Years, which he wrote to his family shortly before he was imprisoned. And the last paragraph of that letter reads as follows: "It remains an experience of incomparable value that we have for once learned to see the great events of world history from below, from the perspective of the outcast, the suspects, the maltreated, the powerless, the oppressed and reviled, in short, from the perspective of the suffering. If only during this time bitterness and envy have not corroded the heart, that we come to see matters great and small, happiness and misfortune, strength and weakness, with new eyes, that our sense of greatness, of humanness, justice, and mercy has grown clearer, freer, more incorruptible, that we learn indeed that personal suffering is a more useful key, a more fruitful principle than personal happiness for exploring the meaning of the world in contemplation and action. But this perspective from below must not lead us to become advocates for those who are perpetually dissatisfied. Rather, out of a higher satisfaction, which in its essence is grounded beyond what is below and above, we do justice to life in all its dimensions and in this way. And in all of his work, all of your work, out of this higher satisfaction, your cantus firmus, if you will, you have illuminated both the essence of what lies below and above, and new ways of thinking about justice and human flourishing in all of its dimensions and its polyphony. Some of you might know that Professor DeGruchy is also the editor of the new scholarly edition of Bonhoeffer's Letters and Papers from Prison, an extraordinary work, as well as the scholarly edition of Creation and Fall. Professor DeGruchy's most recent book, Led into Mystery, Faith-Seeking Answers in Life and Death, will, as I said earlier, be the subject of his lecture tonight. Led into Mystery, he describes as an unanticipated sequel to his book, Being Human, Confessions of a Christian Humanist, prompted by the untimely and tragic death of his eldest son, Stephen, in February 2010, and the questions this posed about the meaning of life and death from the perspective of Christian faith. With his wife, Isabel DeGruchy, who is here tonight, welcome. First time to Charlottesville, and the son Anton and daughter-in-law Esther. We welcome you, Professor DeGruchy, back to Charlottesville. It is an honor having you here, and we look forward to this lecture and the exchange that follows. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Charles, for your words of welcome and introduction. Little extravagant, but that's what I've come to know in Southern hospitality. And I enjoy it, and I'm always delighted when my wife and son and daughter-in-law are here just to hear a little bit about me that's not what they believe is true. I'm going to take the liberty of reading my lecture, I mean, not just in a monochrome voice, but because I know of the time constraint and also the issues that I want to talk about, I've tried to deal with in a fairly careful and nuanced way. I've called this Doing Theology is Being Led into Mystery. Our elder son, Steve, as has already been mentioned, tragically died in a river accident on the 21st of February 2010. He was 40 years old and at the time of his death a professor of theology at the University of KwaZulu-Natal. That's in South Africa. In the weeks and the months that followed, I sought the words to express my grief and at the same time developed a dogged unwillingness to surrender hope. I knew that the enemy of faith is not doubt, but an unwillingness to acknowledge doubt. I'd also learned over the years that hope is not wishful thinking or optimism, but a question posed by faith in a world that gives so much cause for despair and lament. As I struggled with my grief, I found help through reading Nicholas Walterstorff's book, Lament for a Son. Some of you will know Nicholas. In which he reflects on his grieving the death of his son Eric in a climbing accident in Austria in 1983. Sometimes it was too painful to read, but it helped, as Nick put it in his preface, to own my grief. And that phrase stuck with me then and has stuck with me ever since. Owning grief, a step into mystery. To grieve is to be human. Grief binds us all together in the solidarity of our human frailty. For that reason, while owning grief is always an intensely personal and often lonely journey, it is often also a communal experience in which one is embraced, held tight, and in which new relationships are formed and old ones deepened, not least with others who have also experienced the death of a son or a daughter. The week Steve died, four other young men of his age known to us also died tragically. We had unexpectedly and unwillingly joined the company of so many others who have lost children, something which contradicts what should be the natural order of things. Children should not die before their parents die, but they often do, even in this day and age, at birth. Since Steve's death, I've often thought of the many parents who daily grieve the death of their children in countless places where disease, war, terror, and genocide have shattered their lives, or the parents of those children who have starved to death before their eyes on the barren landscape of perpetual drought, or those dying painful deaths because drugs are unavailable to cure or soothe the pain, or those who mourn the death of a loved one who committed suicide. The possible scenarios are endless. Each has to own their own grief. But I cannot begin to imagine how those who have no support, those who have lost all hope, and those unable even to shed tears, cope. That Jesus wept over Jerusalem and wept before Lazarus' tomb makes the necessary connection between the grief we should feel for the victims of injustice and oppression and violence in our world and the personal grief of those who suffer the death of a friend and a loved one. There are neurological explanations for the process of grieving. Traumatic experiences trigger off chemicals in the brain that enable us to cope. Tears are a biological reaction to pain as they are to ecstasy. This is part of being human and why repression of grieving and tears is unhealthy. We are preventing the brain from functioning normally. But grieving cannot simply be explained as the activity of molecules at work in the brain. Grieving is the activity of myself, or more meaningfully, my soul, understood not as a discrete ghost-like being located somewhere in my body, but in complex, dynamic, and relational terms. This accords with the biblical view that human beings are constantly changing psychosomatic wholes in relation to God, the world, and others. We grieve because relationships that give meaning to our lives come to an end as we have known them, even if they may continue in a new way and may be restored in ways beyond understanding. Grief accompanies us through life, and not only in times of death, it is part of the human condition. We grieve if we hurt others, especially those we love. We shed tears when our children leave home or when we move from a house of wonderful memories in which we have lived for years, or when we say goodbye to family and friends after holidays together, or when we say farewell to colleagues with whom we have worked over many years. George Eliot reminds us that in every parting, there is an image of death. For death is the defining moment of parting. Yet if we grieve in hope, we do not have to accept that our relationship with those who have died has ended. The idea that the process of grief comes to an end, that there is some kind of final closure, is only partially true. Yes, there will come a time when the dead move beyond our horizon as our memory grows dim and fails us, for grief is contingent on remembering. But we cannot disown our grief any more than we can get over loving someone we truly loved who has died. If we truly own our grief, it becomes part of our journey in life. An expression of love that endures, even though it changes character as we weave new futures and maybe enter new relationships. It is a journey into the mystery that lies at the heart of the universe, the mystery to which we refer when we utter the word God, inadequate as the word is to encompass all that it is meant to convey. Writing my book, Led Into Mystery, was one of the ways I attempted to own my grief. To examine and express my faith and hope through an ongoing conversation with Steve. But it was also an experience of being led into this mystery. Writing a book is a very public way to go about owning grief. As such, it carries with it the danger of abusing the process through lack of sensitivity to those who mourn differently, and requires prudence in exploring the issues to prevent sentimentality gaining the upper hand. There is also the danger of turning even the sense of grief and being led into mystery into a mental academic exercise, perhaps the most likely and dangerous of all for a theologian. After all, do we not like to think we are the experts when it comes to talking about God and life after death? Yet, if the truth be known, doing theology raises as many questions as, even as we seek, as we must, answers to those that are posed. After all, is everything that I hold true and that has given purpose and direction to my life false, an illusion, or what neuropsychologists call a confabulation, an explanation we construct which is a fantasy of the imagination? Or is it the case that in struggling with the questions that face us in our grief, we are being led into a mystery that is ultimately beyond explanation? Are the answers always questions precisely because they lead us deeper into the mystery we name God? Deeper perhaps into silence before the mystery that encounters us. Christian and any good grief counseling involves learning how to sit alongside those who grieve without trying to offer advice or answer questions until the appropriate time, and even then we do so with circumspection and caution. Rowan Williams, the former Archbishop of Canterbury, has rightly said that the words of faith we try to speak to those who have experienced loss have to emerge from whatever we can do to inhabit their territory, to move as far inside as we can. Even though we may not be able to move very far inside, this is not only sound counsel, but consistent with our belief in God, who heals only by inhabiting the world of death and grief. The much maligned Job's comforters knew that, as the author of the book tells us, they sat with Job on the ground 7 days and seven nights, and no one spoke a word to him, for they saw that his suffering was very great. When Jesus was confronted by the agonizing cries of the Canaanite woman whose daughter was possessed by demons, as Matthew tells us, he did not answer her at all. Was he callous and uncaring, or was he listening intently to her cry for help, waiting for the moment when his words and actions might become a means of grace and healing? Maybe God is silent more often than not because God is overwhelmed by human suffering, perplexed by the pain that cries out accusingly to him, "Why have you forsaken me?" God is silent so often not because God is absent, but because God grieves with us. God knows even more than we do that grief is beyond words. Our inhumanity to others, our crimes against humanity, our unbearable suffering reduces God to silence. But it is not the silence of uncaring absence. It is a silence of solidarity in suffering, a presence beyond words. The early Christian fathers and mothers well knew that theology, like grief counseling, begins in silence, not in asking questions and demanding answers. Not the stony silence of hostility, or the silence experienced by those who are totally deaf, those unable to hear even the gentle song of a small bird at dawn. It is the silence that enables us to listen to that song, to hear the still small voice listening for the word of grace. Grieving teaches us that listening in the silence to the heartbeat of those who weep, and discerning in their pain the heartbeat of the vulnerable God who grieves in solidarity with them and a world in need, that this is the first step into the mystery of God embodied in human being. The world lay in solemn silence when the Word came to dwell among us, and Mary's joyful contemplation was tempered by the anticipation of much sorrow and great grief. Some words on mystery hidden and mystery disclosed. The word mystery has multiple layered meanings. Mystery is used to describe detective novels, the internet, God and the universe, the Christian sacraments, and anything that puzzles us and for which we are at a loss for words. It is also, as Karl Rahner, the Jesuit theologian, told us, one of the most important key words of Christianity and its theology. Doing theology, he once wrote, is being drawn back into mystery. But it is not a shortcut way of solving problems akin to obfuscation. Nor should we take refuge in mystery too soon when faced with the challenges presented to faith by reason and science. Rather, it is the acknowledgement that doing theology is more than intellectual inquiry. It is exploring, no better, participating in something that transcends and ultimately overwhelms us as we struggle with matters of life and death, love and justice, faith and hope. But the journey into mystery is not one that takes us into the realm of the ethereal. It is neither otherworldly or ahistorical. It is being encountered and engaging reality differently as human beings, in solidarity with all creation, with all living beings, with God. My sense of being led into mystery began in a new way the day I sat beside the river where Steve drowned and where his body still lay trapped. In stumbling along the valley of death, I experienced a desolation that could only be expressed in inarticulate groans. I experienced fear and trembling, overwhelmed, as Rudolf Otto describes it, by the mysterious beyond my apprehension and comprehension. But from early on, my brain chemistry began processing and interpreting my experience in a particular way, calling forth a theological response. At one level, my response was simply faith seeking answers, and therefore no different from what we normally do when thinking theologically, whether in the seminar room or in parish ministry. Of course, to begin with, there was no systematic attempt to answer the questions, no possibility that I could stand back and reflect on the painfully raw data of experience. The best I could do was to let the questions come and go, neither repressing or trying to answer them, but bracketing them, putting them into cold storage, and holding them in abeyance for the time being. I had to allow the resources of faith hold me together rather than trying to make sense of what had happened. The same is true for others who grieve. Even though we sit in silent solidarity with them, as we must, questions are already implicit, even if not expressed. Why does God permit such suffering? Is this God's will? What is the meaning of life if it all leads to this sad conclusion? Is there a God? Why did she die so young? Did my sin bring this about? And behind all these inevitable questions, did God raise Jesus from the dead? Is there good reason to love God, or only reason to despair and fear God, even hate the word God and all that it has come to signify? These are all important questions. They take us to the heart of theological inquiry. But the answers of conventional wisdom are inadequate, especially when pronounced with dogmatic certainty and uncritical biblical proof texting. Of all the questions, the most perplexing into which we are led in our grief is that the mystery of is that of the mystery of God's agency and the mystery of evil. Why is destruction not covered by insurance policies referred to as an act of God? Why does God seem impotent in the face of human suffering? Is tragedy God's will? There are reasonable responses to the problem that carry some explanatory weight. If God is God, then surely somewhere, somehow, Amidst such tragic events, God must be present, even if hidden. Otherwise, as Desmond Tutu said in the first Steve DeGruchy Memorial Lecture, God is God's worst enemy. But there is no solution this side of eternity. For the problem remains unjust and inexplicable, haphazard and cruelly excessive, or at the very least a mystery, impenetrable to the rationalizing human mind. That is why any genuinely Christian theodicy, any justification of God, that is, an attempt to justify God's permitting human suffering, must surely begin with the suffering of God, which for Christians is in Christ the revelation of the mystery of who God is. It has become almost commonplace to speak of the crucified God, the suffering God, the God who stands in solidarity with all who mourn. Perhaps far too commonplace. One of the prayers in the Falmouth Prayer Book, which is the community where my wife and I live, speaks of God as the vulnerable God who stands in solidarity with the suffering people of the earth. These words often perplex those who hear them, for how is it possible for the Almighty Creator of heaven and earth to be vulnerable and suffer? Before rushing into glibly answering that question, we do well to remember that the idea that God could suffer was a major problem for ancient Christian theologians. This is neither the time nor the place to engage in that debate that led the early Christian church to reject the idea that God the Father suffered on the cross, or enter the world of Greek metaphysical thought, and note how the terms apatheia and pathos were understood differently to the way in which we now speak of apathy and passion. But at the very least, we should pause on the threshold of this perplexing question, for we stand before what is undoubtedly at the heart of the mystery of God, which led the ancient fathers to speak of the mystery of the triune God. The narrative of the Trinitarian God paradoxically affirms God's freedom and power. God's kenotic, self-emptying love and compassion as distinct yet inseparable. God is neither subject to the passions of ancient divinities nor incapable of suffering with humanity. The shift from a divinity who is impassive to the incarnate mystery of the crucified God provides a penultimate clue as to why God so often seems silent, as we previously noted. God is silent for the very same reason we are silent when in the company of those who suffer, except that God's love is such that he enters fully and redemptively into our pain. God's silence is not the silence of absence or apathy, but the silence of one who grieves totally, because God loves absolutely. It is part of the mystery into which we are led, the mystery of the cross as the outpouring of love. For God loved the world so much that he gave his only Son. How could God not grieve? Bonhoeffer expressed God's own grieving in relation to ours in his poem from prison entitled Christians and Pagans. In the first verse, he writes about how we all turn to God in our time of need. And in the third, how God in turn comes to us in our need. But in the middle stanza, it is about us going to God in God's need. People go to God when God's in need, find God poor, reviled, without shelter or bread, see God devoured by sin, weakness, and death. Christians go to God in his hour of grieving. The journey into the mystery of God's grief, and therefore God's love, is integral to the journey of the self or soul from brokenness into wholeness, the reintegration of body, mind, and soul in Christ. In other words, we return to where we began. The process of grief should not be understood as something distinct from, but rather distinct within, the journey of both life and faith, of dying and rebirth, of death and resurrection. Christian grief counseling that is theologically informed is not simply about enabling people to work through their grief and own it, but to enable those who grieve to be led gently and over time into the mystery of God who grieves, and eventually discover a presence in their lives that is infinitely loving and indescribably beautiful. But this is only after a long and sometimes painful journey along what is sometimes described as the way of unknowing. Some thoughts on the way of unknowing. The way of unknowing begins when it dawns on us that God is beyond our knowing, and therefore that the answers to ultimate questions are also beyond our grasp. To say that the answers are ultimately beyond our grasp is not the same as saying that there are no penultimate intimations that shed light on our path. Christian faith in the mystery of God revealed in Jesus is not irrational and blind. It is not fideism. For while it acknowledges that reason cannot proceed without faith, it also insists that faith needs reason to understand itself. In the same way as Bonhoeffer made the connection between our struggles for justice in the penultimate now and the ultimate justification by grace alone, so we need to recognize that our theological inquiry into the questions of life and death in the penultimate and the insight that we are given now are connected to the ultimate, even though not yet final or complete. There is a connection between what reason illumined by faith enables us to discern now and the ultimate revelation of the mystery when we know even as we are known, for now we only know in part, but then we will know fully. But it is only in the end that the mystery is revealed in its fullness, when we know even as we are known. But now as we journey through life, the revelation of the mystery of God in Jesus Christ does not mean that everything we want to know is disclosed to us, but that everything we need to know for each step of the way is made known to us as we travel. That is why we can only be justified by the faith that we share with Abraham, who went out not knowing where he was going, but trusting in the God of promise and hope, and the God who grieves in solidarity with us on the journey. The journey along the path of unknowing into this mystery is not, first of all, about doing theology in the classroom. It is about lived theology, whether in ordinary time or on the boundaries of human existence and experience, and about being drawn painfully, yet sometimes joyfully, into the embrace of a love and beauty that is both disclosed yet always exceeding what we can fathom. Only this ultimate reality is worthy of the name God, and therefore of our worship, that which makes us pause to wonder and stand rapt in awe, to quote Albert Einstein. Only then in contemplation and reflection can we begin to discern honest answers to the questions that confront us through theological inquiry. But always knowing that those that trip off our tongues are inadequate, spacious, and sometimes downright unhelpful and even hurtful. At best, they can only be preliminary, penultimate. We know that because our answers to the questions of others do not necessarily convince us ourselves when we suffer or grieve. So why should they convince anyone else who want to know why God has forsaken them in their hour of need? Such questions may not bother those who do not believe that we humans are not unique within the animal kingdom. Only flesh and blood, or as Marilyn Robinson has put it, just meat, even though wondrously evolved. It is only believers who can get angry with God and struggle with doubt. Atheists and agnostics who ask questions that imply God, meaning and purpose, are not true to their convictions and must surely be closet or would-be believers. But a genuine, lively faith in God does not answer all our questions. It makes them more complex, urgent, and demanding. In owning my grief and counseling others, I soon discovered that in asking questions, more questions rather than watertight answers became part of the quest, an opening up and a deepening of the mystery into which I was being led. Is this not Job's experience? In answer to his questions, God confronts him with even more questions, virtually assaulting his agonized consciousness with a torrent of demands. Who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? I will question you, and you shall declare to me. Those of us who are theologically trained may think we know the answers until we shift from being Job's comforters to being Job himself, from sitting with others who grieve to being those who grieve. Initially, we cannot even begin to answer the questions they are asking, even for ourselves. We have to travel deeper into mystery with them as we listen to their anguished cries for answers and shed tears with them. And maybe only when we have haltingly begun to own our own grief, uttered our own cries of desolation, and shed our own tears, do we really know that there are no easy answers. We may declare the mystery of our faith at the Eucharist, but can our faith ever be strong enough to carry us through? Is it not rather that somewhere deep within us we acknowledge that the profound and mysterious reality we have embraced in faith is holding on to us? Christians refer to this as the mystery of God's grace, disclosed in the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus. Yet God remains unfathomable mystery even when revealed. For what is revealed, as I have said, is what we need to know about God, not everything that is to be known, or that we would like to know. Jesus, as the revelation of God, is truly God, but not the whole of God. In Jesus, God is at the same time hidden and revealed from the cradle to the cross. Faith in God as unfathomable mystery, disclosed yet hidden in Christ, far from being an abstraction revealed to our experience of reality, implies a commitment to the journey into God as the one in whom we live, move, and have our being. This journey leads us deeper into reality, not away from it. For whatever else the word God might mean, it refers to ultimate reality. And in the course of that journey, we discover with St. Paul that all that finally counts is faith working through love. Such faith is therefore commitment to love that has to be made every day within the realities of the world. It is not a certainty that we possess, but a certainty that comes to possess us in the journey. It's the mystery of grace that makes believing and loving possible in the first place, even if haltingly. The unending quest of science and the theological sense of being led along the path of unknowing into mystery are analogous and converge, even though they usually are expressed differently. When Einstein says that the most beautiful thing we can experience is the mysterious, and that this is the source of all true art and all science, he is referring to that ultimate mystery which transcends art, science, and theological inquiry itself. But being led into mystery requires openness to the possibility of such transcendence. When religion or science turn in on themselves, close the door of the sanctuary or the laboratory to mystery, lose their ability to wonder, their childlike capacity to trust, they become idolatrous, dehumanizing and destructive. The lack of mystery in our modern life, wrote Bonhoeffer, means decay and impoverishment for us. A human life is of worth to the extent that it keeps respect for mystery. To lose respect for mystery is to lose respect for life, for the creation, for the other, for God. It is to become cynical, nihilistic, incapable of hope. To respect mystery is to remain hopeful that what has been revealed will be fulfilled, even if in ways that take us by surprise, for that is the nature of mystery when it is finally disclosed. So finally, grieving in hope. In Led into Mystery, I examine in some detail how I understand Christian hope, and how this connects on the one hand to our life in the world and the struggle for justice and peace, and on the other to the integrity of creation and the ultimate restoration of all things. Believing in the resurrection of Christ means that in the darkest times of personal tragedy or political violence, We affirm that God's purpose for the well-being of creation will not finally be thwarted. In exploring this hope, I also examine such notions as the immortality of the soul, the meaning of heaven and its connection with the earth, and the resurrection of the body, which is the Christian belief. This is not the place to repeat all that I say there. But what I say there provides a background for these final comments. For when Paul writes to the Thessalonians that we grieve but always in hope, what is he telling us about grief? Paul's description of the whole creation groaning in labor pains, waiting for the birth of a new creation, or a new heaven and a new earth, evokes in us an awareness that our grieving is not just personal or communal, but cosmic in dimension. The whole cosmos, it would appear, is grieving its own degradation at the hands of humanity, and in doing so recognizes that its future well-being is bound up with the hope of humanity's redemption, not with humanity's cynicism. This hope is firmly planted on the earth, yet cosmic in expectation, intensely personal, but at the same time interconnected in Christ. Christian hope, in other words, is penultimately related to our struggles for justice and peace in this world, and ultimately to the restoration of all things. It is only within this framework that we can make sense of the New Testament data and the personal confession of faith in the resurrection of the body and the life eternal. The hope that is within us humans is profoundly related to the hope of creation as a whole. What happens to you or me or anyone else after death, Bonhoeffer reminds us, is not the central framing question of the Bible. There are always, he says, more important things than this question of personal immortality. The Christian belief in the resurrection of the body has to do with the continuity of identity and relationships within the context of a new creation, not with the resuscitation of our physical bodies of bone, flesh, and blood in some individual glory. John Polkinghorne, a physicist and theologian, writes, "In natural terms, the pattern that is me, whatever form it actually takes, will be dissolved at my death. As my body decays and my relationships are reduced simply to the fading retention of memories by others. Yet it seems entirely coherent belief that the everlasting faithful God will hold that pattern perfectly preserved in the divine memory, and then embody it in the ultimate divine eschatological act of resurrection at the last day, as the new creation enters into the unfolding fullness of time." If this is so, then God's remembering, recognizing, and relating to me is, as Nancy Murphy says, essential to my post-resurrection identity. But she adds that the continuity of personal identity is only meaningful if it includes self-recognition, continuity of moral character, and personal relations, both with others and with God. This is what resurrection hope in Christ is all about, but only within the new creation. For this is what the resurrection of Christ means. The disclosure of God's mysterious purpose is the substance of Christian hope, as can be seen in passages where Paul speaks about the glory that is still to be revealed and for which the whole creation waits with eager longing. Likewise, to the Colossians, Paul writes about the riches of the glory of this mystery revealed in the gospel, which is Christ in you, the hope of glory. He also writes about our waiting and hope for the redemption of our bodies, which we do not yet see, and concludes with a rhetorical question, for who hopes for that which is seen? What believers know is that what is not seen has already been disclosed in the gospel, but even then it remains unfathomable mystery, for who knows the mind of the Lord, asks Paul. His judgments are unsearchable, his ways inscrutable. There are things not revealed, things that remain hidden until the end. Yet the end has already been anticipated. The mystery still to be revealed will not be contrary to that already disclosed. It will be the unveiling of that mystery in its fullness. Acutely aware of the destruction that was daily taking place in Berlin and throughout Europe, Bonhoeffer in prison came to accept the fragmentary character of life and his own impending death. But he also discerned that which is fragmentary may point to a higher fulfillment, which can no longer be achieved by human effort. That was the only way he could think about the death of so many of his former students in the war. In doing so, Bonhoeffer refers to Irenaeus, 2nd century theologian, to Irenaeus's doctrine of recapitulation, in a passage to which I have frequently returned since the death of Steve. "Nothing is lost," writes Dietrich Bonhoeffer. "In Christ all things are taken up, preserved, albeit in transfigured form, transparent, clear, liberated from the torment of self-serving demands. Christ brings all this back, indeed as God intended, without being distorted by sin. The doctrine originating in Ephesians of the restoration of all things, recapitulatio, Irenaeus, is a magnificent and consummately consoling thought. In the end, Christian hope is the anticipation that the fragments of life, the fragments that we are as human beings, the fragments that we certainly become in death, will be brought to completion as we are finally led into the ultimate mystery of an unfathomable love and beauty that embraces us in life and death. That is our hope, a hope that does not repress grief, does not exclude tears, does not deny pain, but enables us to see beyond them and live in anticipation with the whole of creation of the magnificent work that God is yet to do. Hope is, after all, imagining something different to despair and death. If our belief in God means anything at all, it will transcend all expectation and open up a totally new dimension to our relationship with those we continue to remember and love within the memory and love of God. Only then will the mystery into which we are being led be fully and finally fulfilled. And only then, as John on Patmos perceived as he gazed into the mystery of God's future for us, will mourning and crying and pain be no more. Thank you.
Thank you, John. We have some time for questions and answers, and you'll stick around for a bit.
Sure.
Kind of speechless after that.
I know it's difficult to ask questions when faced with this kind of presentation, but I've had interesting questions in many places when I've talked about this, and quite often it's people who've said to me, "My daughter committed suicide. Have you anything to say to me?" I'm used to those kind of questions now. But they don't have to be those kind of questions. They can be much more academic, if you like, or theological. So,
well, first, thanks for talking. And I guess my question is, you said that God is silent because he grieves with us. There's solidarity in that silence. I guess my question is, what if you feel like he's been silent too long? And I guess you could answer it, well, God knows best. Where do our feelings come in? And when we feel that it's too long?
Well, let me just say that I would not say God knows best, because I think that's one of those sort of answers that is not helpful. I'm not saying God doesn't know best. I'm just saying I think it's an answer that doesn't help. I think we have to ask the question, how does God communicate with us in life and death? And it's often through the embrace of somebody else. It's being able to discern that in that embrace, God is embracing us. But you don't discern that very soon or easily. It sometimes takes time before you recognize that that is, in some profound sense, God becoming present through the other. You're not going to hear a voice out of nowhere. God's way of communicating is always incarnate. It's always in the burning bush. It's always in, and often in the silence. So it's not a question of God remaining silent too long. It's perhaps the issue is when are we able and ready to discern that. It is not God's absence, for God is present, but we don't necessarily discern that and don't... you see, this is the problem with... real atheism is not being able to discern that reality. And it's agonizing. To be an atheist is a very agonizing thing. Because I think that atheists who ask the question of really struggling, they want to believe. Yeah.
John, so glad you're here. In your painful reflections, did you have occasion to reflect on those others you know, I don't mean in your family, but others you know who have grieved, and did you have occasion to reflect on those people before grief and some years after grief? If you have, can you tell us anything about that, about movement in them, or retreat?
I'm new to grieving as an existential thing. I've often been with people who've grieved, and was in parish work long enough to be with many people who grieved the death of children. It does seem to me that I can't answer your question because nothing comes to mind immediately, but I know what you're asking, I think. But what I do think might be appropriate to say is this, that the distinct thing about grieving with people from the perspective of faith is, and what distinguishes it from grief counseling per se, and there are many very good grief counselors are not people of faith, and we can learn a great deal from them. So this has nothing to do with whether that is good or bad. But the distinct thing about grieving from the perspective of faith has to do with walking with people into the mystery that we name God. That, I think, is the distinct thing. It's not answering their questions, because, as I said, those questions are always beyond answer. Even if you sit down with, as I've sat down with many people who've grieved, and we've gone through all the questions, I know all the time that this is really not where it's at. It has to be a shared journey into a mystery that takes us beyond the questions. And I was in Sweden just recently giving a similar talk, and there was a woman who was sitting in the front, and she said, and I alluded to this a moment ago, she said, what would you say to me whose daughter has just committed suicide? I mean, that's a lecture stopper if ever there was one. And I said, I've nothing to say, actually. I didn't put it quite as badly as that, but I actually have no, I cannot even begin to understand where you are at. But maybe I can learn from you as we journey together. You feel quite impotent. It's not that I don't have the language and the words and the traditional answers. I know all that stuff. But I do know that when Steve died and I got letters with all the traditional answers, I thought, oh my goodness, I hope I never say these things to people. And they were all correct according to the book. And they were all so wrong at that moment in time. And one of the people, one of the persons, and a lot of my work, as you know, Peter, has been with secular academics. I mean, that's, I spent most of my life with secular academics, and I always have one or two of them in mind when I write. And one of them was a sociologist who you may even have met when you were in Cape Town, who gave up on the Christian faith a long time ago because he just found the church was totally irrelevant to his life and experience. He was one of the very first to come and visit Isabel and I after Steve died, and he sat down with us with his partner over lunch. And he was like, you know, one of those people who sat and didn't say terribly much, but you knew what he was, you knew something real was going on. And since that day, we've been together on a journey trying to understand, because he's also had some personal experiences of pain, trying to walk together into this mystery. He from a secular, having rejected Christianity perspective, me from a faith perspective, trying to understand what this means. And we've walked together and we've shared emails. I just got one this week from him. And I think that I much prefer that kind of integrity of struggle than any easy answer. And it's not because ultimately we will not understand, or that penultimately there are no intimations of the direction of the journey, or that there is love and beauty that transcends and that is present. But how to actually articulate that in any easy sort of answer? Yeah, well, you know that better than I do. Yeah.
My question is more of a general question, not a personal question. On walking into the mystery, we name God. But do you think part of, since I've been back in the States, I think I mentioned to you I was away for 37 years in East Africa, and I'm still puzzled. I'm not sure of this, but it seems to me that if so many people have said this, that here, I never heard that in Africa, that everyone is afraid to die. Even older people like me, you know, and I'm 78 years old. So, do you think that a part of the grieving over someone else dying, not necessarily, you know, a young person like your child or something, but someone that you're close to, is part of the fear of death that we don't, you know, it's a mystery, you know? And if we don't kind of work at that first mystery, how can we work at the mystery of the death of someone else? That's a question I have for you.
Yeah, I do think, I mean, that when you are faced with the death of someone else, you're also faced with your own death. I think that is the case. And we're not good at that. I don't think anybody, whether in America or anywhere else, is good at that. But in some contexts, death is such a daily reality through all sorts of reasons, for all sorts of reasons, and where what might lead to the and where you've got the resources that may be able to prolong life are just not available. That there's a sort of inevitability. If you do get sick of something, there's nothing much that can be done. So you're living with death, much as the Victorians did, and much as people in many times of history have lived with death. And it may be that we prolong life because we can't handle death, you know, on machines and stuff. I don't know. But I do know, and I can only give you 3 years beyond where I am, death is a real issue. For me, as for you, and as for everybody. And we just don't know. We actually don't know when it could happen. Steve was 48. The last part of my book, I actually pick up on something that Peter Oakes was involved in with Dan Hardy, an Episcopal theologian in Oxford, about what does it mean to die from the perspective of faith. And that's a remarkable story. Really, it's a story that everybody should read, because it says that there's an alternative way of dying to either the cynical way that that's the end, or there's an easy answer to this. Tomorrow he'll be looking down on from heaven on me and probably playing golf up there. You know, those are the ways we sort of joke about it, sometimes from the pulpit, which doesn't seem to me to be taking the mystery too seriously. If you play golf, you know that that doesn't make any sense whatsoever. So we do need ways of learning how to die, not morbidly, because it has to do with learning how to live. Learning how to die is learning how to live. When the New Testament talks about eternal life, it's not talking about life beyond death, it's talking about life now. It's learning to live life now so that death doesn't hold the kind of power of fear that it would otherwise. Doesn't mean to say you're not anxious or fearful, but is an alternative way. And Dan Hardy embodied that in his last months of cancer when Peter and he talked quite a lot. I've not seen anything that remotely comes near to dealing with it like that, so I commend it. Peter, what is the name of the book again? I do quote it in Led Into Mystery.
Wording a Radiance.
I said it in juxtaposition to some other books about dying, which in the end are grieving without hope. I think it does present to us. And there was, you know, in the Middle Ages, when you had the Black Death and all that, you had a lot of writing about manuals on how to die properly. Well, gee, that does sound a bit grim. But you know, we don't really help people how to die. I don't know when you last heard a sermon on how to help people die. I guess you've never heard one, and I've never preached one. So mea culpa. But, you know, everybody who's there, that's a question that unites all of us. And it unites all of us all the time, because Aunt Sally's dying of cancer and Paul's brother was knocked over by a train yesterday. I mean, it's always there in our consciousness. But we can say lots of helpful things about this, that, and the other from the pulpit. And the one question that people are asking, we shy away from because people don't want to hear about that question. So I bother about this, not because I want to get up every time I preach to preach about death. I want to preach about life. But I want to preach about life in a way that has integrity, and therefore that within the scope of talking about life, people can find a place where death somehow takes on a new character. I think that that's what I would like to work at if I was a parish priest. How to do it in a way that helps people who are asking that question without sort of getting up every Sunday and saying, "Now I know all of you asking this question, so let me give you the answer." That's not what I'm saying. It's about understanding life in a way that encompasses the possibility, the reality, the inevitability of death.
Well, first, thank you. Second, I am a preacher of a rural church about 12 miles away, and I was hoping you could write my sermon for this Sunday, because this coming Sunday is the last Sunday of the Christian year.
I'm sorry, I haven't helped you do that.
Well, I think you're on it, so just keep talking. It's the last Sunday of the Christian year. Everything restarts the Sunday afterwards, but it being Reign of Christ Sunday, it's a Sunday that we look towards the ultimate. And so listening to you talk about penultimate time and ultimate time is really interesting to me. And I'm wondering, just by chance, what would you preach on a Sunday like this? Not that I'm taking notes or anything. But, you know.
Well, when I arrived in Atlanta 2 weeks ago and went into, what store did we go into? The big one? One of the big stores.
Costco
or something. I realized that Christmas always came early here.
Doesn't matter which store
you're in. Yeah. But part of the problem with that, of course, that's a commercial enterprise, but I think the clue does lie in the Christian calendar, the Christian year, because we've been through ordinary time for the last, no matter how long, from Pentecost onwards. We've been through ordinary time, penultimate time. Advent opens up ultimate time. So the connection between living through ordinary time is living in the penultimate, and all the issues that we face in terms of life, struggling with life, with all the questions, and in many churches you go through virtually the whole Apostles' Creed to explain it and so forth and so on. Over that, it's the teaching period, if you like. Not that other questions don't emerge, but penultimate is ordinary time. Ordinary time is the penultimate. Now we are faced with the first Sunday of Advent, and we are faced with the question of hope, which is what Advent is about. What is the meaning of hope, and how does it connect to what we've been doing in ordinary time? How does the ultimate experience of life, the life of faith, connect to the ordinary experiences of every day? I think I'd want to work around that in some way, like I've done this evening. But perhaps it would have to be contextualized in terms of your parish, the issues that people face, and see how Christian hope connects with their experience of life, whatever that might be, in terms of not living without hope. And that could encompass the question of death, because you must be having people in your congregation who have cancer and all sorts of stuff. But we need to go through this period of Advent with the purple colors that remind us that this is a period of repentance, of change, of preparation for incarnation. We need to go through this period as those who grieve without, not as those who grieve without hope. I'd be interested to know what you're going to say.
Thank you very much. That was fantastic. I appreciate you sharing. Maybe two questions, if I may. The first, you said that Bonhoeffer and Irenaeus talked about being recapitulated in Christ, and that we can find hope in death. And I was wondering if you could say more about what that means, if that's because Christ is resurrected in glory, that we find our ultimate meaning in that. Then my other question was, talked about a fear of death in our culture, but I also think we have this obsession with death. And I was wondering if you think that's kind of the other side of the same coin.
Yeah. In the first chapter of this book, Led into Mystery, I look at some metaphors and others for death and so forth and so on, and I juxtapose quite a number of books and poems and writings not to do with Christian faith. One of them is by a Canadian author, secular humanist type, who wrote this very good book. And there's a scene in this book where they're having a meal in a restaurant in Toronto. And somebody raises the question about somebody they all know's death. And they sort of tentatively go into that area. But they soon get to the point where they don't want to talk about it. And they don't want to talk about it because you don't talk about these things when you're enjoying a meal out with friends, sort of thing. And it's the point that we've just been talking about. We avoid the issue if we can find another way to talk. And then I juxtapose that with the fact that all of us probably enjoy reading mystery novels in which there is death on every page. I mean, we turn one page and we find there's another body there. And we watch television programs and they're dying off. No matter who the detective is, at least three or four deaths happen before the detective is able to sort the problem out. But next week, back with more bodies. Why do we enjoy reading all the stuff about death in mystery novels? I mean, that's what we do, isn't it? And if there's not a really good death in a movie, you know, somebody being shot or blown to bits, we feel as though we've wasted our money. That's the paradox of our culture. We are surrounded all the time with images of death in what we read, in the newspapers, on the movies, and we even hanker after those images, become morbid about them. The last thing I want to do is become morbid about death. But we all do. But we can't sit down over a meal and talk about it, which is what we should be doing. Now, I don't know what your question was, but that's about resurrection. Let me just say this, and maybe with this one after the, you know, one of the problems with us Christians is that we're very individualistic in our thinking. And as Boniface said, personal immortality is not the big issue in the Bible. Resurrection is. Resurrection from Isaiah onwards is about the creation of a new heaven and a new earth. That's what it's about. So let me just illustrate what I would, the point that I'm making in terms of Steve. Steve was passionate about ecological questions. He was deeply involved in theologies of the earth and ecology. And increasingly so, and widely recognized, I might say, internationally for his work. I don't think he actually cared too much about personal immortality. He cared a great deal about a new earth, and where crying and tears will be no more. And that's what he worked for penultimately. A better earth where fewer people will be suffering because they don't have good water and so forth and so on. And he saw the connection between that and the ultimate resurrection where earth and heaven are both made new. Because the biblical understanding of resurrection is that we are resurrected not as individuals but in Christ. You read 1 Corinthians 15, and that's not only there, but elsewhere. We are resurrected within the body of the cosmos, ultimately. That's a great mystery, says St. Paul. It's a great mystery. And he says, I cannot even begin to explain it. But if we reduce it all to you and me and personal immortality, we miss the point. It's not that Murphy pointed out, and I refer to her, it's not that we don't fit into the picture, but we fit into the bigger picture. And only then does it make sense. So if we're not working for the new earth now, we're not really interested in the new heaven then.
We have 3 or 4 minutes.
Yeah.
May I just ask something that's on my mind? Many of us woke this morning to the tragic news about Cray Deeds and his son. A local congressman was stabbed by his son, who in turn shot himself and committed suicide. And different aspects of that story have been revealed throughout the day. We know that his son was on a medical leave from college, battling a number of mental illnesses. And then late in the day, we learned that the family wanted to commit the son to a psychiatric hospital, but there were not enough beds in the hospital. And I'm not quite sure which hospital it is in Western Virginia, because of some technicality, and he had to be turned away. And I think many of us are mindful of this. This is not, for me, even though my son knows the young man who committed suicide, and we all admire from all sides of the political spectrum Cray Deeds and pray for his continued improvement throughout the day. I noticed in my own kind of appropriation of that, you know, a movement from shock, disorientation, grief, though not the existential grief of the loss of a son, to when I heard the news about the hospital beds and the arrangements and the, against the backdrop of budget cuts and slashes and all kinds of policy issues, into anger. And then the anger was a response, of course, to all of this whole, but it also illuminated some things that needed to be done. And I'm just wondering, just two questions related to your own story, the relation between grief and justice, and where anger fits in that connection.
I would sort of, I'm rather moved by those two incidents that I referred to, of Jesus weeping over Jerusalem, over the injustices, the corruption, the oppression, and all of that, which is going to crucify him, and weeping over Lazarus, his friend, who has died, and incidentally prefigures Jesus' death, because it's after this, according to St. John, that they begin to plot his death. It's after the story circulated that Jesus had raised Lazarus that the religious leaders began to plot Jesus' death. It's a strange thing, but that's the story. So there's quite a connection between this weeping over the injustice in society and weeping over a friend who has died, and in that hearing the word which comes, of course, then is, I am the resurrection and the life. And the question of anger, of course, is connected with Jesus weeping over Jerusalem. It is the going into the temple and with a whip in one hand. It is that. That weeping is the weeping of anger. It's the weeping of righteous anger. That this is not how it should be. That this is not what God intends it to be. And at the same time being able to weep with those who weep the death of a loved one. Somewhere in that, those stories that are interconnected, I think there's gospel.
Thank you again. Thanks to all of you for being here, and with the Groofy family and John for that unforgettable time.
Can I give a plug?
You sure may.
Won't you pass me my book?
Oh, yeah.
I have to do this.
I was about to say something about this book, by the way. The book is not yet available in an American edition, but will be in the next week or two, and we'll be sure and let all of you know.
My wife is a poet and an artist, and also has published a book recently on Julian of Norwich. And if you're interested in Julian of Norwich, it's called Making All Things Well, and it's published in by Canterbury Press in England. But I quote Isabel's poetry in several places in my book, and I'd like to end, if I may, with a poem that she wrote and which I quote. And she wrote it the week after Steve died. When the ordered tenor of our life is shattered by the unimaginable, when the phone call that splinters others' lives rings for us, when a nightmare that horrifies turns into reality, how can we believe that anything could be well again, ever? Anguish breaks over us in torrents, like the torrents that overwhelmed you, submerged you, extinguished your life. But we surface again, we go on living, we face each day, wounded and grieving. We hold on to each other and take a halting step. Can we dare hope that all shall be well, and all shall be well, and all manner of things shall be well again, ever? And those words, of course, at the end come from Julian. Thank you.